Hey, welcome back to part two of Newsprint Commando Pacific Tuesday's coverage of Pacific Comics from January 1983. Looking at Silver Star. No, that's what I looked at to end last episode. Star Slayer, there we go. Issue number six. Which this will be the last issue of Star Slayer that is at Pacific. Mr. Grell moves Star Slayer on to First Comics. Perhaps knowing that Pacific Comics is on is approaching its end. We have only about a year and a half or so left of the Pacific Comics time, so perhaps Mr. Grell knew that was coming. But the book we're looking at was scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Mr. Mike Grell with colors by Steve Olaf. Dramatis personae include Torin McQuillan, who is the Star Slayer. Sam, capital S, capital A, capital M, which is the little robotic monkey sidekick that is on his shoulder. And Tamara, who is his love interest, his rescuer, his everything in this world. And we also see Ferrat, who dies pretty quickly. This is reprinted in the Acclaim Valiant Star Slayer series from 1995, issue number 7. And that slash this is subsequently reprinted in Star Slayer, the Dark Horse 2017 series. No indication of what issue number, so I don't know if that was a collection or what that was. On the cover, we have an image of Torin holding Tamara with one hand, both of them facing out towards us, a lighted circle behind them, and behind that a fire, flamey, explosion-y kind of looking thing. In his forehand, he is holding his electric saber. Tamara is holding a laser pistol. So this is a final image. I believe that a lot of people probably have seen this image. This is a pretty popular Mike Grell reproduced image, this image from the cover here. Pulse-pounding conclusion, we're told. So we open it up, and the inside front cover is a farewell to Star Slayer note from the publisher, Bill Shanes, who says that there's no hard feelings here. I have no idea if there were or not. I haven't read that there were, but it's hard to say. So getting into the story, on her quest, Tamara, with the help of Torin, has collected all of these medallions from the different rulers of the different peoples slash colonies of the solar system. And they all look like, and I'm looking here to refresh my memory, I think they all look like diamonds on a chain. But I can't find that. Yeah, here they are. Yeah, they all look like gold diamonds hanging from a chain at the upper end of the diamond. 2, 4, 6, 7 of them. Because she knows that these can be used to accomplish a particular task. A task different from what she was asked. She knows that they can be used in a way that differs from the way that the people who asked her to collect them presume that they can be used. They think that they can be used to somehow address the desire for ultimate power, whereas Tamara knows that they can be used to save the human race. Kind of a much higher level of usage, you know, wouldn't you say? So, she's collected all of them. Torin and she are not now on their way back to Earth from the outskirts of the our solar system. And this is where the individual Ferrat that they had taken on under the guise of being a merchant that wanted to help. He's an agent for the people, the Earth Council that Tamara is supposed to be working for. And he is an agent to keep an eye on her. She found that out a couple issues ago. And here they come to blows and Torin ends up killing him, shooting him through the head. Actually, with his down, he's above him, and through an opening, he shoots down through the body, and it looks like it comes out near where his rear end would be. So the laser shot goes all the way through the body. Pretty cool image, I think. So the Earth Council loses contact with their new agent. They have kind of cut bait on Tamara. They know that they can't control her anymore, so they have stopped really trying to deal with her. Instead, they've been dealing with Ferret, who they could control, was still under their thumb. Well, now they have lost him, so they have lost complete contact and or control with Tamra. They roughly know what she's doing, but they don't know how successful she is. They don't know where she's at or anything like that. So they send out actual fleet forces to find the Star Slayer and destroy it. So now Tamra knows that that's what they're going to do. Well, she presumes, anyways, that that's what they're going to do. So now she and Torin have to get back to Earth, but stay hidden long enough in order to be able to do that. So the first thing they do is they use the asteroid belt there on the outskirts of Mars's orbit. What is that? On the other side of Mars, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, asteroid belt? Yeah, wherever it is. They're flying through the asteroid belt. And right about the asteroid belt is where the Earth forces catch up with them. So there's a shootout here. They destroy, they being the Star Slayer, Tamra and Torin, on board the Star Slayer, destroy those Earth forces and get to the vicinity of Earth's moon, where they are re-engaged by another cadre of Earth forces attempting to stop them. These folks so intent on stopping them that they pretty much destroy the moon and a colony of people that are on the Earthlings, human beings that are on the moon, to try to destroy the Star Slayer. To no avail. The Star Slayer gets away. They go into the small ship that they have on board called the Bowsprit, and they use it to escape. They get to Earth. They hide in some tunnels that no one knows about except Tamra. Gain entrance on foot in person to the facilities there on Earth, and ultimately to the chamber where the Earth Council is meeting. Four gentlemen, and I will say they're not all white gentlemen, but they are four males, one of them of non-white lineage, it looks like. So here we find out what is going down. They wanted the amulets because they would be able to do something with them and it would give them ultimate power. Well, Tamra has found out in both her research and her jauntings around the galaxy that the people, which are the Earthlings, but they're early Earthlings, before really Earth peoples broke up and started colonizing the rest of the solar system. So these are like not our ancient, but ancient Earthlings to them, had designed a system that was going to save humanity. And physically, this system, this device, what have you, involved the usage of all seven of these amulets. Okay, so what happened at some point in Earth's history is that the sun went nova, and then I think contracted is what is supposed to happen in a star's life, and it consumed Mercury and Venus. Didn't expand enough to hurt Earth, although there was a flare that did some damage to Earth. But then the sun receded, and now it doesn't give off enough energy really to help Earth as much as when the sun was healthy. So the ancients came up with a plan, and it involves a major, they never did use the word here, but I believe it's called a conjunction. Is that, I think where all the, where some amount of planets come into alignment. This was a great, I'll say conjunction. I think that's the right word, where not only all of the planets, but all of the moons of all of the planets are in a line with the sun. And at this particular one, the Earth is on the opposite side of the sun from everything. Knowing that at some point in the future this would happen, the ancient peoples, when they created these devices to be used, these diamonds, over time they had been taking all of Earth's nuclear waste and pumping it into the Earth itself, trying to get it near or into the core of the planet. So they built a machine that, when activated with these diamonds, in association with the gravitational pull of all of these planets on the Earth, on the opposite side of the sun, and the vast amount of nuclear material that is now contained within the Earth, the machine would link with the gravitational wave of all of these celestial bodies in alignment, pulling the Earth with this nuclear material into the sun and reigniting the sun. Now, all the people of Earth have to get away, which Tamara warns them. Once this starts, the process will take like 24 days, something like that, to do. So she uses these diamonds while the council is watching and sets all this in motion, actually using also an armband that she gave Torin as a gift because she knew Torin would keep up with it, not let it be taken because it was a gift from her, and sets all of this in motion. Ultimately, everyone leaves the planet, and Tamara and Torin now and the Star Slayer are free to go wherever in the second chapter of this story, as it will be told at First Comics. And that basically is this story, is the end chapter to this story here. We have an advert for Alien Worlds. Subscribe to these exciting comics coming from Pacific Comics, and it's the same advert I spoke of, although it's a different comic book that they're using to draw your attention. The subscriptions are for the same books that I spoke of in the first part of this episode. We then go to a full page ad of color that explains to us in May you need to buy Bernie Wrightson, Master of the Macabre. I believe that's how you pronounce it. M-A-C-A-B-R-E, Macabre, some people. I pronounce it Macabre. Number two, and Edge of Chaos, number one, from Gray Morrow. Another big name that Pacific has managed to get. And then we get from Craig Deely. Now, this was scripted, penciled, and inked by Craig Deely. The colors and letters are unknown. And this is, and I'm going to read this one to you because it's kind of a poem set to pictures. Donner Beck's Machine, A Cautionary Tale. Now, we have illustrations that illustrate these things that I'm about to say. There was a jolly Deutschman, his name was Donner Beck. He made the finest sausage and sauerkraut and speck. He made the finest sausages that ever you did see, until one day he invented a sausage-making machine. Oh, Mr. Donner Beck, how could you be so mean? I told you you'd be sorry for inventing that machine. Now all the neighbors' cats and dogs will never more be seen. We've all been ground to sausages in Donner Beck's machine. One day a boy came walking. He walked into the store. He bought a pound of sausages and laid them on the floor. The boy began to whistle. He whistled up a tune, and all the little sausages went dancing round the room. By day and night he made the verst. The piles and mountains grew, till soon there just was room enough for Donner to squeeze through. They ate them hot, they ate them cold, until they almost burst. But Donner Beck kept grinding, still more got verdammt verst. One day the darn thing busted, he couldn't make it go. So Donner Beck, he crawled inside to see what made it so. His wife, she had a nightmare, came walking in her sleep. She gave the crank an awful yank, and Donner Beck was meat. And that is the second story in this book. Inside back page, an advert, black and white, for The Mysterious World and Art of Arthur Soydam, new portfolio release. And outside back cover is a color advert for Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné. Thank you, Stephen, for explaining how to pronounce that. Of issue number two by Roy Thomas, P. Craig Russell, and Michael Gilbert, at your local comic store soon. All right, our fourth and final book we're looking at is Twisted Tales, issue number two, with a big spanking Bernie Wrightson cover. Well, about two-thirds of the page. The top third is covered by the logo for the book, which is unfortunate. So this has many creators assigned because there are four stories. Now, it does have Bruce Jones in common. He wrote all of them. So and again, we have a Bernie Wrightson cover. We have a gentleman chasing a couple people. They are running. He is carrying a bloodied axe with a bunch of heads tied to his waist, kind of like a belt. And he's just a big, normal-looking dude. I mean, he doesn't look like a monster or anything, but he's doing some monster acts there. Axe, A-C-T-S, even though he's carrying an A-X-E. Yeah. All right. The inside front cover is Twisted Mail, about the first issue of the book. First story, Over His Head, scripted by Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Mike Plug, colored by Steve Olaf, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Kerry McCarthy turns out to have lettered all the stories, and three of the four stories were lettered by Steve Olaf. So the and all four stories are written by Bruce Jones. So generally, just the art changes, and one of the artists also did colors. But this first one, Mike Plug, Over His Head, starts out with a gentleman in a wetsuit rowing out in a rowboat to a particular part of a lake, puts on a oxygen tank and dives in, intent on weighing her down. So she'll stay down there at the bottom with all the little fishes. Yep. Where are you, Lila, honey? Where'd you go? Joe's a-coming for you. It's me, honey. I'm coming down to see you. That's both vocal and in his head. Then we go back in time a month earlier, and we see Joe. Is that what he said his name was? Yeah, Joe. He is looking for a room for rent, and he's talking to the landlady. She's escorting him around, asking him questions about himself. And is it this issue? Yeah, there's like things in two or three of the stories in this issue that would be a no bueno in comic books today. There is here, the landlady makes a reference to people who prefer relationships with people of their same gender, and she uses a pretty slang word here for that. She goes on, asks him if he is that kind of person, asks him if he's on drugs, asks him if he is a hophead, and then asks him something else here. Disparages against Jewish people on down here. Not really asking him a question, but just in conversation. Well, the room that she has available has a big aquarium in it that was left by the previous tenant and a tree. And that's how she gets into the conversation about Jewish people, the tree. Yeah, I didn't get the connection. So Joe takes this room that has this big fish tank in it, and he finds a doll also, and he hangs the doll on the tree, kind of like, I guess it's supposed to have been an old Christmas tree, but it doesn't look very piney, like a pine tree to me. It looks like some other kind of tree. But Joe finds this doll and hangs it on the tree. Then we see Joe as he's at work, working the job that he has to get money to pay for the room, but also to impress this young lady named Lila. And he does impress her enough eventually that she comes back up to his room with him, and they do the deed. And he is pretty happy with the deed, and she seems happy enough with Joe and the deed. So she starts hanging around, and before the next time they do the deed, she asks Joe for a favor. Most of the favors are some way of improving their living conditions, whether it be furniture or a new mattress or, you know, she's asking him for things. And she is using sex as the leverage to get Joe to do this, which Joe wants to have sex with anybody. And this is a good looking girl, particularly the way Mike Plug draws. Wow. Some of these panels are just awesome. So Joe continues to do it. And every time she ups the ante, ups the ante, ups the ante. Joe gets more and more over his head, or gets underwater, I guess you could say also. As far as the money, one of their dates, he takes her out on the lake in a boat, you know, and when he asks her to marry him, she starts laughing at him, and he gets mad and throws her over. Goes back home, and as he's in his apartment, there's a knock on his door, and the landlady is there saying that the police want to speak to him. So we see him leave his room, and this is then where we catch up with the very beginning of the story. He's in the rowboat, wetsuit, air tank, goes down and starts to weight down this body from where Lila fell into the lake. And as he's trying to weigh her down, her hair entangles him, and they start to wrestle around, and we get the impression that he dies. Well, the final page of the story is the police breaking down the door, and we see that Joe's head is in this fish tank with this doll at the bottom of the fish tank, and that's where he drowned. All the stuff that he got for her, he got for the doll, pretending that it was Lila, and it's all dollhouse furniture because she is a doll. So we have here on the floor all of the different furniture and belongings that he has purchased at her behest, and it was all for a doll that I guess he then pretended that he had sex with. I don't understand how you fit in the sex part, but then he got mad at her and pushed her in the fish tank here, and he went in the fish tank after her, and that's where he drowned. Kind of, yeah, weird. Full page color ad here. Pacific Comics presents Michael Moorcock's Elric, on sale in March. Then Edge of Chaos by Gray Morrow, beginning in May, a 3-issue miniseries by a Master Comics Arts. The language there is kind of off. Explore an ancient world of fantasy through the eyes of a modern-day hero. You've never seen adventure like this. Watch for it from Pacific Comics. Next story is Night Watch. And again, this is from Bruce Jones. Penciled, inked, and colored by Ken Stacy. Lettered, Kerry McCarthy. And this is a story of Ike, who is an unknown individual. He's just in charge until the very end of the story. More importantly, Hacker, Brubaker, Meyer, Beckman, Sharp, Rothstein, and Mettbauer are soldiers. And they sleep through the day and they come out at night and they are in foxholes in the sand. And they wake up and their mission is to get from the foxholes in the sand to the sandcastle without being caught. Ultimately, this group does get caught, and it gets caught. You find that they get caught by rats, and the rats take parts of the body, as rats do. You know, they'll bite off a limb or whatever, but the soldiers don't die. They just continue on without that body part. Happens two or three times. Right before they get to the sandcastle, there's one more, and you find out that there is also some other difference in the soldiers, that some of the soldiers can be bitten and carried around by this rat, or rats, plural. And when they are dropped by the rat, they are okay. They haven't lost a limb like some of the earlier soldiers have that were attacked by rats. So finally, a group makes the same castle, and we get there, and we back up and back up and back up and find out that Ike is a little boy that owns toy soldiers. Some of the soldiers are tin soldiers. Some of the soldiers are new plastic soldiers. Either way, he collects them up and he plays with them, leaves them out, whatever. And the end is he's playing with them here. And his mom comes up to him and says, Ike, get your suit on, honey, and bring your toys. We're going to the beach. So the entire story from the soldier's perspective are they're toy soldiers. And that's the bum, bum, bum part of the story. Next one up, Infant Terrible. Bruce Jones, this one penciled in ink by Val Merrick. There you go, Billy. There's another Val Merrick story for us. Billy and I interviewed Val, and it was on one of Billy's shows, I think late last year, maybe early this year, I think late last year. That is Magazines and Monsters, if you want to find that Val Merrick interview, about an hour long. Colored by Steve Olaf, lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Long, long text box to open the story. We find out that there is an Ulagene Kincaid, and now, this is presumably Bruce Jones. Ulagene Kincaid sprawled seductively on her parents' lumpy, threadbare sofa, raven hair flowing like dark waterfall about her slim alabaster shoulders. She stretched one leg perfectly shaped. She stretched one long, perfectly straight. Okay, sorry. She stretched one long, perfectly shaped leg toward the worn-away living room carpet and flicked absently at a piece of loose threading with her bare foot. She sighed loudly, stretched, arched her slim back until the thin scrap of material that passed for a blouse strained precariously against her swelling adolescent bosom. Ulagene, the most beautiful, most desirable young woman in all of Holcomb County, all the local bucks were yearning to get to her and now. As her parents had just discovered, one of them at least apparently had. And that's where the art starts. Dad, in his nasty wife beater, is yelling, "You're what?" And mother, in her nasty moo-moo, is yelling, "You're what?" And she says, "Pregnant, pregnant, pregnant. Judas, are you deaf? I ain't exactly thrilled about it myself." Dad backhands her, yelling, "Slut!" Yeah, quite the family. A much more mean family in a lot of ways than the Paynes were in the previous issue. And I might not have gotten that across enough because I didn't want to go into it too much. Read that story and see. Those were some bad people. So anyways, Ulla May is pregnant. And it's kind of a twofold issue here. Mom and Dad, particularly Dad, are upset because she's young, too young. She's not betrothed. She's pregnant. But she was promised to a local businessman. Let me see. Where was it? Here it is. I forget what he owns. He owns some kind of factory there nearby. Steel mill. There it is. I'm sorry. He owns the local steel mill. And she is betrothed to him, and the dad, you know, is going to feed off of the son-in-law. But between that and the fact that his daughter is too young to be pregnant, he's kind of upset. Upset it's going to mess that up. So they have a dinner with the young man, ensuring that he can't tell anything is off with Ulla Jean, first of all, Ulla Jean. And after that dinner, mother and father and Ulla go to a local witch, and they get a witch's brew to get rid of the problem. Now, in my naivete, I didn't realize until farther along in the story, I connected some lines, which is what Jones wanted you to connect. But I didn't get it to begin with. What happens is the witch makes Ulla drink a concoction. Ulla starts vomiting. Your daughter, will throw up for a week, then be fine. And the witch is holding a bucket. Now, Ulla has been vomiting into the bucket. The dad takes the bucket and dumps it out the window. The witch tries to stop him, but he dumps it out the window. Now, what they dumped out the window was the aborted fetus. All the abortifacts, aborticants, whatever you call that, of the vomiting that Ulla has done. Several panels here occur back to back. One is a couple gentlemen of color, which is good to see, are fishing, and they fish up something that is a funky, weird-looking creature. And in the background, we see the steel mill. So that tells us that the steel mill is poisoning the swamp. Then we cut to the witch, and there is a bubbling, gurgling in the swamp just outside of the witch's home, approximately where the dad threw the abortifence that came from Ulla. We next see Ulla carousing with three dudes here, none of them the steel mill owner. So she is still sowing her oats. And they all get together and they go out to see the witch for some reason. I don't know why. But one of them goes snooping around, and they realize that he's snooping around when his head comes bouncing back into the room. The room that he was in has this grotesque, froggish, greenish, humanoidish thing that attacks them, chases them all off into the swamp, kills the people one by one as it catches up with them. One guy it catches and grabs him by the legs and pulls him apart like a wishbone. Chasing Ulla, Ulla runs and runs and runs. She runs to the church. Now she is virtually bare-chested as the slight frock that she had on has been torn away through her running through the swamp and being grabbed and torn by all the plants and what have you. She runs to the church just in time to come to where her wedding is. And she closes the door behind her, sitting on the floor, shirtless, laughing hysterically while something is beating on the backside of the door, wanting to get in. So that's the end of that story. Full page ad from Ms. Mystic, issue number 2 from PC Comics. The final story is Speed Demons, and that is scripted for us by Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Rand Holmes, colored by Steve Olaf, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Now, to open this story, we have an image of a city with a taxi driver here driving through the streets, and he is being hailed by a couple, and he pulls over and picks them up. Kebby picks up the couple. As far as I can tell, it's a young man, a young woman. To be honest, reading the book and being from 1983, I have no idea how they identify, so we'll just go with a young man and a young lady. The dude tells the, now the man and lady, dude and chick. Is that what I said? Yeah, dude and chick. No names, but the dude keeps telling the taxi driver, my girlfriend likes it fast. Ooh, drive fast. Speed turns me on. Right? What is that? The Will Smith song? So the cabbie, you know, and most of the scenes are from the cabbie's perspective. As he's driving around, the young man and young lady apparently in the back seat start going at it. Tells the dude that, you know, I need to know, the cabbie tells the dude, I need to know where you want to go. You know, I need a destination. And the guy's like, just drive. So the cabbie starts driving. And then you, every now and then you hear the girl, you know, moaning or encouraging, whatever. My girlfriend wants you to go faster. There's a speed limit, buddy. Money gets dropped on the front seat from the back there. The cabbie looks at it and says, okay. So he starts going faster. The girl, you know, moans and whatever. And the dude says, my girlfriend wants you to go faster. And the cabbie objects, more money. This happens two or three or four times as the cabbie is trying to go through different parts of town. He goes over to the Wharf Harbor area. He's driving through a more residential area. Finally, to get up to the speeds, he goes across a big cable bridge here to some open countryside. The guy finally tells him, my girlfriend wants you to go 70. Or no, wants you to go 100. And the cabbie says, 70 is as fast as this will go. And you keep hearing the girl, yes, yes, that's it. That's almost it. And then the cabbie's like, well, I can't go any faster. He gets out of the country, tries to make a turn here, flips and rolls the car. And the girl, as the car is crashing, is screaming out, yes, yes, you did it. And so all's quiet here. We cut to the guy who we see a image of him, and he is way messed up. And he says, my neck wouldn't move, but my eyes did. I caught a look at my reflection in the dangling rearview mirror. It wasn't pretty. Then he looks again, and the young man and young lady are standing outside the cab. You're dying, mister. But my girlfriend wants me to tell you that you did real good. It was real nice. My girlfriend wants me to thank you. And then they turn and walk up the hill, up to where the road is, and they hail another taxi cab and get in it and take off. And that's the end of that story. Back page, subscribe today. Same, this is a color of Captain Victory. Same books, Captain Victory, Silver Star, Grew the Wanderer, Elric of Melnibone, Twisted Tales and Alien Worlds. Inside back cover, another black and white advert for the Art of Al Williamson, the one spoken of previously. And then the back cover, all color, on sale, Alien Worlds number 2. In this issue, Aurora by Dave Stevens. And the cover is by Dave Stevens. Man, dude could draw. And that is the line. A, you know, sub A, the dude could draw sub A. He could draw women. Dave Stevens, there are few people that I have ever seen that draw as attractive a female as Dave Stevens does. We're told in April, Science Fiction Stories of the Future, today, written and edited by Bruce Jones. Now, I've already spoken on a previous episode of Alien Worlds number 1. Last Pacific Tuesday, maybe, or the one before that. And so, that is the final of our Pacific books for today. Let me take a quick gander here, and next will be February 1983 books, and we will hopefully be looking at Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers 10, Elric of Melnibone 1, Sergio Aragonés Grew the Wanderer 3, and that's it. Just 3 books next time. So, but before that, that'll be the next Pacific Tuesday. Before that will be an Amazing Comics episode talking about issue number 3 of X-Mutants. So, for those of you that like X-Mutants, next episode. For those that want more Pacific, a month from now, the next Pacific Tuesday. Either way, hopefully I will talk to somebody then. Ciao.